Again, you're listening to Truth Quest with Melody, and we're in a new time slot. We're an hour earlier, so our programs will run from 8 to 10 p.m., and I hope that's more convenient for some of you who have a tendency to have to get up the next day and go to bed around the 9 o'clock area. So I hope you'll be able to join in and listen. And we've got an email site, khen.dj@gmail.com, if you want to email any questions or to the program. And my co-host this evening is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, a professor of geography at California State University at Stanislaus with nearly 30 years of teaching experience. His academic research has focused on using ancient soils, paleosols, and landforms as a means of reconstructing climates and environmental conditions of the past. And our special guest this evening is Howard Hayden. And I believe, before I go there any further, though, I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and are my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And I want to also bring up the fact that we had a great membership drive where we brought $3,159, but we're open for memberships all year round. So please feel free to join and contribute to the great programming that we provide this community, and we're always looking for volunteers who want to come in and add to the flock. So, Dr. Carlstrom, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. And would you like to introduce our guest?
Yeah, it's a pleasure to welcome Howard Hayden to our interview tonight. Let me just say a few words about him here on a bio. Howard Hayden is a professor emeritus of physics from the University of Connecticut. A Colorado native, he entered the University of Denver as an engineering major, but soon discovered that he wasn't temperamentally suited to all that reality. He switched to physics and went on to earn his BS, MS, and PhD at DU, University of Denver. On receiving his PhD, he went to the University of Connecticut, where he spent 32 years doing teaching and research. He did accelerator-based atomic physics, including measurements of cross-sections for various processes, measurements of energy loss and atomic collisions, and of lifetimes of excited states, beam foil spectroscopy, and ion implantation. Hayden has a long-standing interest in energy, stemming from before the OPEC oil embargoes of the 1970s. Presently, he publishes a monthly newsletter, The Energy Advocate, which in August 2010 began its 15th year of publication. He has written a couple books, The Solar Fraud, Why Solar Energy Won't Run the World, and A Primer on CO2 and Climate, both of which advanced to the second edition. The Solar Fraud has sold out and has been supplanted by A Primer on Renewable Energy. And I should mention, Howard, that I have my students in some of my classes purchase your primer on CO2 and climate, and I'm also going to have many of those same students listen to this interview, so this should be a nice way for them to get to know the author of one of their books. And so welcome to the show, and maybe I'll start by asking you, since we started off with this, I know we can range our discussion on topics such as energy and climate change and CO2 and pending legislation. But perhaps a good place to start would be, since Melody played this song, Give Me Some Truth, how much truth do you find in Al Gore's movie, An Inconvenient Truth?
Very little. In a word, he's a master propagandist, but he bends the truth out of shape quite a bit in his book, and in his movie. And in fact, I have my own quarrels with the IPCC, but he totally misrepresents them as well. In fact, his movie was being shown to school children in England, and a court ruled that it was so riddled with mistakes that they couldn't show it as a classroom exercise unless they told some of the things that were actually wrong with it.
So he gets high marks as a propagandist, but low marks as a scientist, and low marks on telling us about reality and the challenges that face us. Now, about the realities that face us, you're interested with this newsletter, The Energy Advocate. What are some of the themes, Howard, that you'd like to go into in that newsletter?
Well, if I just wrote about energy, it wouldn't take me 15 years. In fact, I could write everything that a citizen would want to know about the energy question in a matter of a few issues. But mostly I write about fools, which there are an infinite number. It's been going on for a long, long time. We keep hearing people who think you can run this industrialized giant called the world on sunbeams and chicken manure and breezes, and it simply isn't going to happen. So there are just many foolish things people say about that, and so I pick up on these foolish things and then remind people, readers, of what the actual physics is all about. So that's what's been going on for years and years.
Okay, so bottom line is that we have a world civilization that gets about 85-86% of its energy from fossil fuels, even with Obama and some Democrats talking about going green and trying to meet Kyoto Protocol targets of scaling back our quote-unquote carbon footprint, our carbon emissions. I imagine you have some thoughts about some of the pending legislation that, like the climate security bill that I believe Boxer is behind and Kerry, and is still working its way, trying to work its way through the Senate. Can you tell us what you think about the logic, the intelligence, the vision of that particular bill?
Well, it's a matter of politicians sort of entering into an arena where they have just understanding of what is going on. Let me explain just a little bit about the question of carbon dioxide. We know that the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere is increasing. We know that the temperature has increased with fluctuations over the last 150 years or so. During the last decade or so, the temperature was going down until the very recent El Nino, which seems to have spiked and is almost finished by now. But in any case, the CO2 is going up, and the temperature has been going up all this time, and it is all too tempting to think that correlation is causation. And it turns out that there is a causative effect, but it's not the one that people say, and that is that when the Earth warms up, the oceans warm up perforce, and that puts more CO2 into the atmosphere. And curiously, the mathematical relationship is identical to the mathematical relationship where CO2 acts as a greenhouse gas, which means that it's really mathematically impossible to tease out how much is cause and how much is effect. But in any case, we know for certain that the CO2 has been rising, and the ocean temperature has been rising, and they're very, very strongly correlated, and that is because the CO2 is being emitted from the ocean. In fact, the IPCC has a graph showing, well, it's not really a graph, it's kind of a cartoon with a bunch of arrows pointing this way and that, but they point out that the pre-industrial amounts of CO2 emitted by and absorbed from the atmosphere to the ocean. What used to be about 70 gigatons of carbon per year, and now it's up to about 90. Well, if just our burning of carbon dioxide were to be the cause of the increase of CO2 in the atmosphere, one would expect that the flux of CO2 into the ocean would increase, but it certainly doesn't explain why the flux of CO2 out of the ocean increases. So the only way you can explain that is on the basis that the warming ocean is the cause of the increased CO2 in the atmosphere. Okay, that much said, there is a relationship between CO2 and temperature, and it's not the one people usually say. Another part of it is, what is the harm if CO2 increases, and what is the harm if the temperature increases? Well, we have some ancient records saying that the dinosaurs lived when the atmospheric concentration was between about 4,000 and 8,000 parts per million. Presently, it's around 390. So we have a factor of somewhere between 10 and 20 or something like that to go before we get to the concentration that the dinosaurs lived with. And when you think about it, you look at the size of the bones of those creatures and you say, you know, they had to live in a very, very verdant time, because you can't grow creatures that big unless there's a whole lot to eat. And so the very high CO2 concentration there, and CO2 is, of course, plant food, led to much bigger plants in a very, very verdant world. It was indeed warmer. It was about, somewhere around 4 or 5 degrees C warmer than it is now. But, of course, that goes ahead and explains why they had so much CO2 in the air, because it was, the oceans were warm, and that's where the CO2 came from. So the increase in CO2 is not harmful. The increase in temperature is not harmful. And as a friend of mine who is a skeptical climate scientist is wont to say, well, there is a greenhouse effect due to CO2. CO2 is increasing. The temperature is warming. It's not a bad thing. We can handle it. Go find something useful to do. And we wish Barbara Boxer would.
Yeah, and of course, part of the whole equation here is that even in just our country, the government has been doling out close to $2 billion a year in research monies specifically for people to look at the issue of human-caused climate change rather than simply to look at climate change in and of itself as a natural phenomenon. So there is a political push for particular kinds of conclusions, and there's a lot of money to make that a reality, make it happen. So,
that's certainly true. But there's another great pool of money, and that is that Al Gore started a $300 million propaganda campaign a couple of years ago in order to promote his global warming scare. And the funding of it has gotten into everything. There are very many websites that are linked to Al Gore's principal website on this. And when you go to museums, it's hard to visit a museum without being hit with the propaganda. You can't watch a nature and science show on TV without being hit by the propaganda. And it's just highly infectious, and it's hard to blame the ordinary citizen for being a little bit frightened by all this, but it's all just propaganda that's doing it.
That's a very good point. As a professor, I like to, sometimes I find DVDs and videos to be very useful, but I have had to be very careful. I found some good DVDs on this topic, and there are some good ones, like the Great Global Warming Swindle, for instance. But there are also many, as you say, that link our energy use with global warming, and it's you see it in so many books and so many videos that the public is going to get the message that this is just the way it is, and so that is hard to counter that. And you're tracing this back to that $300 million propaganda campaign that Al Gore was associated with. Pretty much.
Yes,
but I suppose it's wider than that as well.
Oh, I'm sure it is, because there's probably Soros money behind it as well, but I don't know that. Interesting, about the cap and trade and taxes that people have in mind for reducing carbon emissions, take it as axiomatic that all the wind and all the solar and everything else is not going to run the world. And in fact, it's very hard, even nuclear, which has plenty adequate energy, is going to have a dickens of a time trying to run our transportation system. What kind of an extension cord are you going to use on your car? And, you know, the batteries aren't going to work and so forth. So the upshot of it is that the attempt to use cap and trade and so forth is really an attempt to limit energy usage. So let me explain just a little bit about economics at a very, very fundamental level. Suppose that there is a shortage of some commodity. Now, what happens in a free economy is that somebody figures out there's a shortage because and the prices start going up. So they increase manufacturing, thereby increasing the supply. And when they increase the supply, the price comes back down. It may not come back down as far, or sometimes it'll come way down because improved manufacturing techniques have actually reduced costs and so forth. Okay, now if we get to cap and trade and that sort of stuff, carbon taxes and so forth, you got to understand that the purpose is not to raise money in ostensibly. The purpose is actually to diminish the supply. And in fact, the plan of the IPCC and of Congress is to reduce CO2 production, which means reduce the use of our coal, oil, and natural gas by 85% by 2050. And that's a phenomenal reduction, and the purpose is to reduce the production of CO2, which means to reduce the amount of energy usage. And this creates a shortage. But what it really amounts to is laws against resupply. And so you don't have a free economy working there. You have a distorted economy where the supply is actually forcibly limited by government. And what is that going to do to the price? Well, let me give you two examples of the horror of that sort of thing. The first we have is the prohibition, which jacked up the price of booze by quite a bit and brought us the friendly mafia. Now we have the war against drugs, where the purpose is to limit supply, and we have drug wars going on and super high prices, and you and I are in danger of being mugged by somebody to get a couple hundred bucks or whatever in order to get through the next day's drugs or something like that. It's a real horror, and that's what happens when you mess around with the marketplace.
We often hear about this thing called peak oil, which is a term from geologist M. King Hubbert, who worked one of the petroleum companies back in the 50s and 60s, and predicted that for any given oil patch, an oil field, a state, a country, the world as a whole, there is in effect, a bell-shaped curve which shows the path of production of that oil supply over time, so that you start out at zero and you reach a peak, and then as the supply is of readily pumped reserves is cut in half, as you reach that halfway point, then the bell-shaped curve has to go down. And many would say, some would say that that we are at peak oil or very near it, or we're at a plateau of peak oil, and the guesstimates are somewhere between 2005 and 2035 or something for this condition, and that it's not something we can legislate away. It's just a physical reality of the earth and the fossil fuels, or the oil in particular, in the ground. Do you see a connection between this peak oil phenomenon and all this cap and trade stuff?
Well, yeah, certainly that's the story. The only thing is that Hubbard didn't really hang a date on this, but he said that eventually, with exponential growth and a finite supply, you're going to run out. And, you know, that's, you know, just elementary, simple mathematics. The thing is, we just don't know how much oil there is, because we don't even know what the source of the oil is. It's pretty clear that it's not dead dinosaurs, and there seems to be, well, to give you an example, we have enough methane clathrates, which is sort of a compressed and hydrated version of natural gas, down on the continental shelf under the ocean, to last at current U.S. energy rates, that's total energy, for something like 3,000 years. So there is no really big hurry on that. I mean, we like to find better and more sources and so forth of energy, but at least we're not in any desperate need. We don't need to do anything in the next 10 minutes or the next 10 days or the next 10 years. We may have to do it in the next 10 centuries.
Howard, yes? Wouldn't the depth of where there are some of these new drills that are so deep into the earth also be a factor in proving that that it isn't a fossil fuel, because it goes way below the depth of where any life would have contributed to that?
Well, that's probably, but we have to know the geologic history perhaps better than we do. I'm sitting here at about 5,000 feet elevation, and I'm on an ancient sea bottom. So we know that the we've had rises and falls of the various parts of the tectonic movement and so forth that amount to many thousands of feet, and going down something like 5 miles is probably getting to the limit of where something might have happened, with dinosaurs or ancient ferns or something like that. But I think we're probably beyond that, and you could be right. But the more direct version is if we look at Titan, which is a moon of Saturn, they have oceans, literally oceans of natural gas. And we've seen natural gas all throughout the solar system. Why would the universe, or why would the Earth not have its own supply of primordial methane? So we probably have it. We just have to sort of change our thinking and change our habits in order to find it. But in any case, we have plenty.
I've heard this idea that out of the ocean floor in particular, this methyl hydrate, was that what you called it?
Methane hydrates.
Methane hydrate, yeah.
Or sometimes called clathrates.
Clathrates, yeah. That this natural gas is in a near-frozen state, since it's cold down there, and that this may even have contributed to some extent to the explosion of the BP well. I've read, although you read a lot of speculation about that. But, yes, I've also read that there may be so much of that stuff on the ocean floor or below the ocean floor that we, as you say, would have thousands of years' worth of fossil fuel energy to tap into. Now, is that an accepted theory, or would you say that is still kind of one theory?
Well, there are many people that accept it. The Russians have accepted it for many, many decades, and many Americans do, and some of them don't. Since I'm not a petroleum geologist, I have no way to. I simply don't know enough to get a sampled opinion. But then again, what really matters is what you find.
Okay. Well, to go back to my question, on the relationship between all this global warming. Pending legislation, versions of the Kyoto Protocol that would call for radical scale back of our use of fossil fuel. On the possible relationship between that and peak oil, you find that to be kind of a weak connection, or do you think it's more driven by a different agenda, one of say profiteering and control of kind of the deindustrialization of our society?
Just a second, gentlemen. I just want to say that this is – I've got Professor Eric Carlstrom and retired Professor Howard Hayden speaking about global warming and various aspects of that, and this is Truth Quest with Melody. So go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm not very good at getting into people's heads, and I try to avoid – ascribing motivations to people who do things. I understand money is a very strong motivator, but I also know that there are people out there who are rather fanatic simply in their beliefs that the human species is a scourge on the earth, and that everything that we do is somehow or another sinful crime against the earth and so forth. So there are probably many motivations behind all of this, but I do know that money is a big motivator. There was recently a carbon exchange, which is part of a sort of a network of people who have gotten together to trade carbon credits, which is totally mythware, but anyway, they have had a great financial loss simply because the cap and trade bill isn't going to pass. And so, you know, hooray for that. But that just shows that money was a motivator in that particular case.
Yeah, I think we've established in just by reading and on previous shows also that Maurice Strong of the United Nations was involved in founding the Chicago Climate Exchange, which and Enron, before it went bankrupt, was also instrumental in trying to get this kind of legislation passed so that certain major corporations could trade carbon credits. And Goldman Sachs, amongst many others, is poised to. There's a huge sector of the financial services that want to trade carbon credits, kind of as to create the next big Ponzi scheme bubble, perhaps like the housing bubble. But as you say, the legislation doesn't look promising. The climate legislation was passed in the House, but it has stalled in the Senate. And you don't see good prospects for that. Is that correct?
Not at the present time, but you have to regard the people behind this as in a regrouping mode. They haven't been defeated, and they probably never will be defeated because they come crawling out of the woodwork. So you have to be constantly vigilant against that sort of thing.
So the cap and trade ultimately is a pay to pollute.
Well, yeah, cap and trade was actually begun as a way of sort of finding a capitalist solution, as it were, to some real pollution, and that was that there was a gradually declining standard for how much you could emit, and of pollutants like sulfur dioxide and so forth that really are harmful. A company is granted a certain amount of permission to emit as much as they have been, and then if they improve their situation, then they can sell some of these credits and make a few bucks on the side and so forth. And so that's the but there was gradually declining cap and so forth, and so it worked. It was a way of essentially putting the noose around the neck of people who were polluting too much, and it did work pretty well. But the problem is that there is just simply no way to burn coal or oil or natural gas without producing carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is an odorless, colorless, non-toxic gas. And it has been vilified in the press. And so, by the way, one thing we should understand about carbon dioxide is that there is a certain amount of carbon dioxide that goes into the air every year because of the rot of detritus and emissions from the ocean and respiration and all kinds of things that are natural. And there is carbon dioxide that goes into the air because humans are burning coal, oil, and natural gas. But it turns out that our combustion of those fuels only puts 3% of that carbon dioxide that goes into the air. The rest of it is totally natural.
Yeah, and I think we should also point out that, some 80 to 90% of the total greenhouse effect is due to water vapor, which of course is also completely natural, and there have been no attempts to try to legislate against water vapor. So you can kind of see right there that that this whole thing is really not about fixing the climate; it's about something else.
Yeah, it's a lot of it is about manipulating people into some kind of a worldview about the earth we live on, and then there's a money motivation and so forth. But you're absolutely correct that the big greenhouse gas is water vapor, and it's a far more effective gas, both in terms of the breadth of the spectrum, in other words, the range of wavelengths that it absorbs, and in terms of total quantity, because there's just typically 100 times as much water vapor in the air as there is carbon dioxide in the air.
Yeah, so that we see that the total contribution of our activities to this thing called the greenhouse effect is actually much less than 1%. So when they talk about mitigating the climate by changing our behavior and reducing our carbon footprint, this is simply erroneous information. This is simply not true.
It's a flea on an elephant's behind. Just totally nothing. You're right on that.
As well, the idea that, and of course, the computer models give most of the quote unquote grist for the alarmists, in the sense that they make these projections. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, is associated with about two dozen computer models that show a range of warming, always warming, never cooling, in the next century of about 2 to 11.5 degrees Fahrenheit. Choose your projection, but they never show any cooling, and this is all based on computer models rather than based on reality. But based the assumptions of the models are that carbon dioxide is the main driver, the main forcing factor in climate, which I think we can pretty much conclusively prove is not the case, as you mentioned earlier.
Howard, is there any way that you would project or could possibly project, when you were saying that they're regrouping and going to come back at us? Do you have any ideas of what they might be trying to come back and, you know, reword or change the language or the thought process so that they can come and implement this in a different fashion?
Well, I don't have any projections or any guesses as to what their wording would be, but I would say that if I consider an analogous situation of the nuclear power, there was a lot of hysterical screaming about nuclear power 30, 40 years ago and so forth. And it has it abated while we didn't build any nuclear power plants, but now that people are considering building nuclear power plants again, the same screams and hollers are coming from more or less the same quarters. It's probably somewhat different people. So I would just say that they're out there. So one way or another, people are going to be totally frightened about this, unless there is something that comes along which is, in fact, extremely likely, and that is that we enter an ice age. The ice ages, well, in a way, we are in one long million-year ice age, which is. Characterized by cold, they call it glacial periods that last something like 90 to 100,000 years, and interglacials, when it's warm as it is right now, that last perhaps 10,000 years, and it has been about 20,000 years since the depth of the last ice age, and it's sure to happen again sometime. Now, the reason behind those ice ages it has to do with the orbit of the Earth and the tilt of the Earth's axis and variations in those things. They're called Milankovitch cycles. So it will happen that we will enter some ice age, and it's going to be a long, long glacial cycle of probably somewhere around 100,000 years. So I don't know as how you and I will be here that long, but it will happen.
Yeah, I think just for perspective, I like to bring up to my students the kind of the emerging worldview that we get from a number of books and authors, that our species, Homo sapiens, seems to have evolved about 130,000 years ago, which is when we were in our last interglacial period. So what we see, if we look at the Earth's history and the history of living creatures, we see that warm periods are periods of expansion, species flourish, they live, they come into being, economies boom, and these cold periods that you're referring to are periods where we have extinction, we have social disruption, we have shorter growing seasons, shorter lifespans. So a cooling is actually much, if one wants to be afraid of the weather, which probably not very intelligent use of your emotional energy, but at least be smart enough to be afraid of cold temperatures rather than warm temperatures, which historically are associated with wealth and prosperity.
Yes, of course. And in fact, on a shorter time scale, you just go to a local emergency room and look at the records of how many people come running into the emergency room with various kinds of problems and so forth, and they peak out in the coldest weather.
Yep.
So a couple of interesting things about the history, not extending back to the real ice age, but through the little ice age. They have discovered, well, because the glaciers have receded quite a bit in the Alps, they have discovered some Roman lead mines. The Romans were up there in the Alps, way up high, digging mines to get lead. Now, they didn't go up there and find themselves on top of a gigantic glacier and think, oh, I'm going to dig a hole right here and see if I can find some lead. No way. They had reasons. They were on the solid earth, and they dug in and they found lead. And, of course, the Little Ice Age came along and covered the whole thing up with glaciers. And so now in this particular warm period, it has receded. Glaciers have receded far enough to expose the lead mines.
Yeah, I think we can extend back our kind of little history and climate lesson. And what you're talking about is the period called the Roman Warming. The Roman Empire was expanding in a time when the climate was a little bit warmer, and I think it's something like 600 BC to 200 AD, something like that. Maybe it was the other way around. Maybe it's 200 BC to 600 AD. I can't remember, but it's right around the BC AD period, followed by the Dark Ages, which was a period of cold weather, which was followed by the medieval warm period, which is the periods in which the Vikings expanded to Greenland and Iceland between about 900 AD and 1300 AD. And then that was followed by the Little Ice Age, where the climate was 1 or 2 degrees centigrade colder than now, where the bubonic plague, the shorter lifespans, etc. So we see that these natural warming and cooling cycles have had some pretty big impacts on the history of cultures, especially European ancestors.
So you're kind of saying that maybe the Romans could have contributed to a global warming?
Melody, I have to cut in because I can't hear you at all. So
okay.
I don't know what you're saying, but what I just said I was offering to Howard to comment on.
Okay.
Well, sure enough, let me give you a little vignette of things. You're aware that the United States is kind of a beer country, whereas Italy and France are wine countries. Now, why is that? Well, during the medieval warm period, they were growing grapes up all the way through the British Isles, and they were making wine. Along came the Little Ice Age, and the grapes wouldn't grow anymore, so they started making booze. In other words, beer out of grains. And it was those people who came to the New World, and they brought their habits of beer drinking with them, and that is why the U.S. is a beer country rather than a wine country. And so it's just a little story there. But another thing is that, story due to Tim Ball, who is a climatologist in Canada. He had some nice pictures of some gardens in the up in England, where what they did was to slant their gardens to the south. In other words, they built up berms in order to get better sunlight during the Little Ice Age, because that was the only way they could grow crops. It's very clever of them to do it, but after all, they were simply responding to the climate as it was there and then.
Yeah, we've had the good fortune to interview Tim Ball four times on our show, and it came out in one of the interviews that he was a PhD student of British climatologist Hubert Lamb, who has done a lot of work on climate and human history, and one of the real experts on that. So, yeah, Tim Ball is one of the quote-unquote climate skeptics or climate deniers, if you will, and has taken some heat for his being brave. But, yeah, he's still going strong and tremendously knowledgeable and has lots of good stories like that, yeah.
He really is a wonderful character, and he kind of bristles at the term climate change denier or something like that, because his business is studying how climate has changed over the long history of the Earth.
Yeah.
If there's anything he and other climate skeptics know, AGW skeptics know, is that the climate has changed, it always has changed, it always will change.
Yeah, and this is kind of a fundamental problem, because even as I read through some of the kind of the modern literature, it seems that the term climate change, and of course, since we've been cooling since about 1998, what we hear about now is not so much global warming, but we hear climate change. And you even in your book, you talk about the acronym HIGWIGS, which is human-induced global warming-induced global cooling, which, of course, is a an attempt to rationalize the fact that our global warming is causing global cooling. But what my point was that climate change, those two words, when I went to school, meant natural climate change. But those terms have kind of been co-opted now to mean, even without saying it, but to imply human causation. So climate change, as it's used in Congress, is more likely to mean human-caused climate change. So it's very hard to kind of fight against this implied meaning, which is not specified.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the old horror movies, especially of, who was that famous director? Hitchcock. Hitchcock never showed the villain, so to speak. That was always hidden from view. Even in the movie Psycho, you never got to see any horrible thing really happening. You only knew it by more or less implication, and the imagined horror was always worse than the real horror. So in this case, what they do is they toss about the term climate change, and simply avoid answering the question or even raising the question whether A, humans have anything to do with it, and B, whether it is good or bad. The implication is that humans are responsible, and yes, it's bad, but we're sure not going to say it because somebody might quarrel with it.
Yeah, it's a very interesting, subtle kind of linguistic, I guess, coup, you might say, that word has been co-opted to that extent. And but Melody, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut off your question altogether. Do you remember what you wanted to ask him? And if you could speak up as loud as you can, because I'm not hearing what you're saying.
Well, that's okay. I was just being facetious anyways, because you were saying that they had a warming period during the Roman times, and I thought I could just throw in the fact that did they contribute to the global warming? So,
well, yes, it was the Roman SUVs, but they got buried in the labyrinths, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is an interesting theory by a guy named Wallace Brooker, who is a paleoclimatologist who wrote an article, I believe, in Scientific American, in which he raised the question whether perhaps humans had been contributing to the warmth of the present interglacial, the Holocene, by our agricultural activities, which, of course, started a long time ago. It was more or less just posed as a kind of a question. He didn't answer it one way or the other, but he suggested that maybe as far back as 10,000 years ago, humans could have some impact on the climate. I think it would be very small myself. Do you have a thought on that?
Well, I would suppose that it's pretty small. I mean, how many humans were there, for gosh sakes? And what could they possibly do? And after all, the CO2 concentration in the atmosphere is controlled by the ocean temperature rather than the CO2 controlling the temperature of the Earth. So it's, well, there are many things that actually are involved in the Earth's temperature. Now, one of them is the amount of sunlight that varies a little bit. And that can actually explain more or less half of the variation that we see. But even then, when you look at solar intensity, you're looking at the broad part of the spectrum from ultraviolet through infrared and so forth, and it's coming from a sun that's around 5,800 degrees on the surface and so forth. But if you believe that's all the sun can do, then you're at a loss to explain why the tails of comets point away from the sun. In other words, it was known for a long time, or somebody discovered, that the tails of comets actually point away from the sun. And somebody did a calculation based on the known temperature of the sun and said, you know, that couldn't possibly send enough stuff that far out into space, you know, past Jupiter or something like that, to force the tail of the comet to go away from the sun. And so there was a Mexican standoff, so to speak, until we found ourselves getting into outer space and we actually found the solar wind, which is an electrodynamic phenomenon. And, oh, all of a sudden we have a reason now why these comet tails should point away from the sun. And when the climate people talk about the sun, they pay no heed whatsoever to the variations in the sun, and they also pay no, well, I shouldn't say that. They say that, yeah, it's a small effect. That's what they say. But they pay no attention to those very violent phenomena that are clearly strong enough to push the tail of a comet away when it's five times as far from the sun as we are. And those things simply don't enter into the calculations these people make. So, but anyway, there are other things, such as the albedo of the Earth, which is the reflectivity. A very slight change in the albedo of the Earth can cause a considerable change in the Earth's temperature. And then there are things like the ocean cycles. There are short-term cycles like the El Nino Southern Oscillation, which goes back and forth between El Nino and La Nina. There's the Pacific Oscillation. There's another oscillation in the Atlantic. And there are some long-term cycles that run thousands of years. And those all have an effect on the surface temperature. So just trying to put that into a computer and get it figured out is really quite an effort. And in fact, I have a nice demonstration that I have a video of where somebody has what's called a double compound pendulum, which is basically a stick hanging on a stick, and the upper stick is hanging on a pivot and so forth. And you start swinging this thing, and you get some motion out of that that is totally unpredictable. And you can't solve that with a computer. I mean, if you know the conditions that are happening right now, you can tell what's going to happen in a matter of the next 4 seconds or something like that. But you have to have infinite precision in all of your knowledge about the friction, about air friction, the shapes of the things, the exact conditions, velocity, and so forth, in order to be able to predict very far into the future. Well, if you can't solve that with a computer without all that super high precision knowledge, how can you possibly put together computer models that are able to explain climate over 100 or 1,000 year time periods? I mean, it's a fool's errand.
I think you're right. It is a fool's errand. There's a great paragraph that I'd like to read out of a book by Professor Ian Plimmer called Heaven and Earth, Global Warming, the Missing Science. And I actually am having my climatology class to read that, this book, this semester. On page 11, it says, calculations on supercomputers, as powerful as they may be, are a far cry from the complexity of the planet Earth, where the atmosphere is influenced by processes that occur deep within the Earth, in the oceans, in the atmosphere, in the sun, and in the cosmos. And the next sentence is the one I really like. To reduce modern climate change to one variable, CO2, or more correctly, a small proportion of one variable, i.e. human-produced CO2, is not science, especially as it requires abandoning all we know about planet Earth, the sun, and the cosmos.
Yeah.
I think he sums it up. Yeah, and in your book, you make the point that there may not just be one cause for a particular warming, that you may have synergistic effects of many, 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 many different factors. And there are so many different factors that affect the very, very, very sensitive atmosphere climate system that to try to put it all on a graph with an X and a Y axis, it may be the height of folly to say, oh, well, 1998, that was all due to El Nino, or 1981 is all Pinatubo, or this cooling is due to this, or this cooling is due to that. Maybe that is a stretch that is not justifiable.
Yeah, in the laboratory we can do an experiment where we change exactly one variable and then we see an effect from that. But with all natural phenomena, there is just plain no such thing as the cause, and that's just all there is to it. Incidentally, Eric, I've never met you, and Melody, I've never met you. We're sitting here on our telephones in our respective places, and I certainly haven't met any of the readers who are listening to this show, but let me say that we all have one thing in common. We probably have more than that, but there's one thing of interest in common, and that is we have been in a room, an auditorium perhaps, where somebody was messing with the sound system, and all of a sudden there is this horrible screech. And the screech is caused by sound from the speakers being heard loudly enough at the microphone that it gets into the microphone, gets amplified, gets worse and worse and worse, and you get this scream. We've all had that experience. And this comes from what's called positive feedback or regenerative feedback. Now, suppose this happened sometime, and instead of having somebody cover up the microphone or turn down the amplifier or do whatever they did, pull the plug, suppose that everybody just walked out of the room and locked the door. Now, that scream would persist.